Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 5th of January. Happy New Year. It's 2015 and our first All Things Political for the first Monday in January. Lisa Mascaro will be joining us this hour. Lisa covers Congress in Washington and writes about U.S. policy, economics, and political culture for the L.A. Times Chicago Tribune. Today she writes in a story headline, Republicans take helm of Congress, but initial course is unclear. Tomorrow, Republicans take control of both chambers for the first time in 8 years. The question, of course, is what course will they set and where will they challenge the president? Speaker John Boehner has said there will be a direct challenge to the president's unilateral actions on immigration. What about health care, spending? Will it be hard to find a middle ground inside the Republican Party? Democrats are also facing their own rift. Lisa writes, liberal Democrats in Congress have been loyal foot soldiers for their often unpopular president. Now a rare clash between President Obama and members of his own party suggests Democrats on the left may be marching in a new direction. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Of course, the big question of the hour is, what would you like to see Congress accomplish during the year 2015? Do you think there will be compromises between Democrats and Republicans? Do you expect more gridlock this year? What actions would you like to see taken on issues like the Keystone XL pipeline, immigration reform, taxes, et cetera? The lines will be open for you all hour. Hello, Lisa. Happy New Year. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thanks so much for having me, and Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you. So are Republicans excited today? Are they all in town getting ready for the big day tomorrow?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a little sleepy start here. They will all be rolling back into town tonight and in the morning. The halls are a little bit quiet. I was just out in the halls, and gosh, there weren't, you know, the galleries are not open, so there are no tourists coming in to see, you know, the chambers, though, you know, some of the folks are down in the rotunda, so there's that going on. But I think, yes, to answer your question, Republicans are quite excited. You know, this is the first time since 2006 that they have controlled both chambers of Congress is the first time under President Obama, and they are certainly raring to go with a sort of long list of items they hope to do, though they're still finalizing the list a little bit. So that was kind of interesting to see that after all was said and done after the election, that Tuesday's is a little bit of a work in progress, or this week. But yes, I think there's a great enthusiasm among the Republicans for what they think they can do.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with the Keystone XL pipeline. Mm-hmm. Will the House be voting on that perhaps as early as tomorrow?
Yeah, they are. They're looking to do that. I wouldn't say tomorrow. I think more likely would be later in the week. Tomorrow is a grand day of pomp and circumstance here with the ceremonial swearing in of both the new members of all members of the House, because of course they're up every 2 years, and then all the new members, the new members in the Senate, and of course we'll have the election of Speaker Boehner tomorrow, which we can talk about when you want. But that is likely to take up most of tomorrow. The House is considering a bill tomorrow, or is likely to consider a bill tomorrow. But it's not quite Keystone yet. The way I was hearing it was that Keystone would probably be toward the end of the week. Look for it maybe a Thursday vote.
Mm-hmm. Speaker Boehner has talked about immigration reform and that he will take up that issue pretty soon. What options do the Republicans have when it comes to changing what the president has already done?
Yeah, that is going to be probably one of the most difficult issues for Republicans in this new Congress, because they so desperately want to respond to President Obama's executive actions, yet finding a response that all Republicans or enough Republicans to create a majority can agree to is almost impossible. So what they will do right off the bat is try to halt funding or tweak funding for the Department of Homeland Security. As you might remember from the end of the lame duck session last Congress, you know, though the Congress did approve a massive spending bill for most of the government agencies through the end of the fiscal year next for, through next September, they only funded the Department of Homeland Security for the next several weeks into early February. And that is their pinch point to try to take some action on what President Obama has done by way of his executive action, which will allow up to 5 million, you know, immigrants who are here illegally to, you know, remain in the country without fear of deportation. So what the Republicans will do to respond to that remains a serious work in progress. Republicans are very interested in passing reforms for immigration that could, you know, say, tighten border security. Those kinds of things are fine and well, but it doesn't sort of address the elephant in the room, which is, you know, what you do with these people who are here illegally. There is a great political risk for Republicans to lean too hard into that issue, because among Latino voters, this and just Latino Americans in general, this policy that the president has created is enormously popular. Many American families have what's called mixed status families, where some people in the family are here legally and others are not. You know, you can imagine the situation where a father comes over 20 years ago to work in the country illegally and ends up marrying and having a family. Those children are raised here, you know, as American, of course, American citizens. I've talked with countless families that, you know, one sibling was born here and the other was brought over as a young child illegally. So it's a very emotional issue for Latino families. Also, Asian American families, other minority families in this country who are dealing with this and who have been watching their members under the threat of deportation. The Republican attempts to roll that back is going to be very politically difficult, yet there is great enthusiasm among many Republican members to do that by, mm-hmm. you know, halting the money or putting language in the bills to restrict what the president is doing. So that's going to be a very difficult needle to thread for Speaker Boehner.
Democrats have their own set of problems, and we'll get to them in a moment. But you mm-hmm. have talked about the Republicans having a difficult time, will find it difficult to establish some kind of middle ground inside the party. You say a series of issues, including immigration and tax reform, party leaders must bridge the divide between Tea Party supporters who want to use the new Republican majorities to move aggressively against the president and the more pragmatic wing that wants to avoid extreme positions, particularly in the run-up to the 2016 presidential race. So how do they work that all out?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the struggles that we've seen Speaker Boehner go through since the 2010 election, when he became Speaker in 2011 with his, you know, House rambunctious House majority, those divisions and dilemmas will now shift to the Senate. And we got a preview of this during the lame duck session last year, last December, when, you know, Senator McConnell, who will now be the Senate Majority Leader, he's the Republican leader from the state of Kentucky, you know, had worked out an arrangement with Democrats, with Majority Leader Harry Reid, to finish the spending bill last year. They thought they were all said and done, and then Senator Cruz, late Friday night, after Senator McConnell had already left the building, you know, staged a bit of a revolt and was able to sort of force this dramatic weekend session, keep everybody in, as Senator Cruz was trying to, again, dismantle the president's executive actions on immigration. So you could see that kind of situation arising again and again and again on any bills that Senator McConnell is trying to get to the floor. First up, as you mentioned, is this Keystone bill. Now, Senator McConnell has promised that he will have a sort of free-willing debate in the Senate, that he doesn't want to run the Senate the way many believe that Senator Reid ran the Senate, you know, as a very sort of top-down approach, no amendments, you know, you got to take this bill, take it or leave it, we're going to have a vote, you know, end of conversation. But no, McConnell says he's not going to do that. He's going to offer free-willing amendments. Well, people might remember in 2011 when House Speaker John Boehner promised this, one of the first bills they had was a spending bill that they needed to pass, and, you know, it was a week later and 300 amendment votes later, you know, and they finally got the bill passed, you know, and some may say that's fantastic, the way democracy works. Others may say, you know, that's going to really gum up right. works in the chamber. And again, if you have some of the more conservative members trying to offer amendments on, say, repealing Obamacare, you know, stopping Obama's executive actions, you know, opening more lands to oil drilling, opening oceans to oil drilling. You know, you can envision the kinds of amendments that could get real dicey real quickly for both parties, members of both parties. And so, you know, that's going to be the challenge on both the policy in front of them, you know, for Republicans trying to say on tax reform, trying to just get a common ground on the specific issue, but then also trying to not let all the extraneous issues, like we've talked about Obamacare, immigration, you know, trying not to let those extraneous issues, you know, detour them or derail, you know, the issue at hand.
You mentioned Senator Reid. He took one nasty fall last week to break bones in your face and all those ribs. How's he doing?
Boy, yeah. You know, Senator Reid has really, you know, he's taken a licking over the years. He's had some difficult physical and, of course, you know, political challenges. And I tell you, you know, when that came over the transom Thursday that had happened, you know, we all checked in. Well, how's he doing? And, oh, yeah, he was fine. He was talking to senators from the hospital room. He, you know, he fielded a call from the president. He was cracking jokes and witty as ever, you know, with his sort of wry Western humor. So, you know, I got to say, Senator Reid is 75 years old as of last month, and he just seems to show no signs of slowing down. He, I will just say, you know, he did have this fall. He was working out, I guess, with a resistance belt on an exercise device.
I don't know about those.
Yeah, I guess it snapped. It broke somehow.
Oh,
and so that's what hit him and caused him to fall. And so you can imagine that sounds kind of not very, very good. But we'll see. You know, I haven't seen a picture or seen what he looks like, and we'll see what he looks like when he gets back in. He had fallen on his morning walk a few years ago. He tripped and fell on it because he walks publicly. And, of course, with his, you know, security detail, and came to work with a black eye and his arm in this sling. And I had, some readers had emailed me and said, you know, good grief, what happened to Senator Reid? But, you know, he ran the Senate. So that's just kind of Senator Reid. He's a, you know, he's a tough guy, grew up in the desert, you know, hard father was a hard rock miner, you know, in the outskirts of Vegas, you know, a little dusty searchlight. That's Senator Reid. He's just a fighter.
Yeah. Let's move to the Democrats. They have their own set of issues. We ended the year with this debate about whether or not favors were being granted to Wall Street. And you talk about liberal members in Congress who have been, as you call them, loyal foot soldiers for their often unpopular president. Now a rare clash between the president and members of his own party suggests that Democrats on the left may be marching in a new direction. Is that likely to continue?
Yes, I think that is something that has been sort of kept under wraps these last 4 years. You know, we saw some of the Democratic divisions when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, and she had to sort of, you know, keep a strong hold over her majority at that time to accomplish some of President Obama's, you know, top agenda items, including the passage of the Affordable Care Act. The Democratic divisions have been sort of quieted as the Republican Party divisions have come to the fore. But we saw real quickly after the November election sort of what we always call the circular firing squad, right, where everyone was blaming everyone. The Senate Democrats were blaming Obama for not having used the bully pulpit of the White House and his position as president to articulate a strong middle-class agenda. Of course, the White House, you know, thought that the Democrats in the Senate ran away from, you know, some of the top priorities, you know, didn't, I think President Obama had recently said in an interview, you know, that the party as a whole didn't stand up and fight for what it had accomplished, again, with the Affordable Care Act and some of the other provisions. So we saw these divisions. You see the more liberal members of the Senate Democratic caucus really standing up, Elizabeth Warren being elevated to a leadership role. She's now maybe number five in the leadership party ranks. She will be helping to form the party's message. You saw also some of the more conservative state senators will be voting, you know, for the Keystone Pipeline. Some of them also voted against Senator Reid when he, you know, said he was going to run, now no longer majority leader, but he would be his party's minority leader. Well, you know, he needs to be elected by his party to do that. And several Democratic senators who had been what you would think of as those sort of loyal foot soldiers said, you know, no more. No, I'm not voting for you. And so those kind of divisions are sort of a new wrinkle that we haven't seen in a few years that I think we're going to see a lot more of.
We welcome phone calls. It's All Things Political for the first Monday in a brand new year, and Congress returns tomorrow. The Republicans take over both chambers of Congress tomorrow. There are divisions, as Lisa has outlined, within the Republican Party, and there are divisions within the Democratic Party. Let's look at some of the issues that will be taken up. The Keystone Pipeline, probably early on. The president's actions on immigration, whether or not anything can be done. There will be some major votes, Supreme Court, and we'll have to ask Lisa when that decision is coming down to roll back the president's actions on health care, the Affordable Care Act, a very important case that the Supreme Court is looking at right now, and we'll find out when that may be decided. Other issues, of course, taxes, and as we move into, and we're going to hear a lot about 2016 this coming year as well, how will that influence both the Democrats and the Republicans? How will they position? Is there a front runner on both sides? And how will they position their agenda to make it more favorable for whoever the candidate happens to be in 2016? And the big question is, do you expect, with all these divisions for quite a few years now, do you expect there to be any important decisions made in 2015? Congressionally. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. You can always send an email at talk@wpr.org. We love reading your messages on Facebook, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Lisa covers Congress in Washington, and she also was Washington correspondent for the Las Vegas Sun. She's an economics and political science grad of UC Santa Barbara, studied in Budapest, Hungary as well, and she is now the Washington, D.C. Reporter covering Congress for the L.A. Times, Chicago Tribune, and other papers at the Tribune D.C. Bureau. To you, momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All Things Political this hour. Congress begins its new session tomorrow, and we're talking about the Republican control and the issues. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you. Jim in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hi. The problem today is, as I see it, is it's not that people aren't smart enough. It's just that people don't want to work hard enough. And working hard means doing a lot of reading and thinking and putting point A and B and C, disparate points perhaps, in disparate books together so that you can have a big picture. You can get that type of thinking in the book Power Systems by Noam Chomsky, and you can also find this in magazines like Z and Mother Jones and In These Times. And if you read and do a little bit of work, you're going to find that especially on issues of regulation, that people like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are not to be trusted, and that all we have left is are people like Elizabeth Warren and Saunders, and perhaps also Dennis Kucinich. So it's a sad time, and it's a very difficult time, and we just have to do the best we can and keep plugging along.
How much influence does someone like Senator Elizabeth Warren have in the Senate and nationally, Lisa? Is she considered to be a leftist extremist? Is she respected? Is there a possibility that she could become even more of a national politician?
Yeah, I think you should definitely keep an eye on Senator Warren,
really?
Elizabeth Warren this year. Absolutely. I think, you know, there are always, you know, the sort of what we say the wings of the party, right? The liberal wing, the conservative wing. But Warren, Elizabeth Warren is showing herself to be quite savvy in how she's going about her work. And while some may initially just sort of say, well, you know, she's just sort of representative of the liberal wing and that's too extremist, she's being very conscientious about how she's going about trying to achieve her goals. And I can give you an example of that in just a minute, but I will say, you know, I don't think it's any surprise that the Democratic leaders gave her this leadership post in the new Congress, and that's a nod to the importance of that wing of the party. And you know, there has been this growing movement among progressives to draft her to run for president. There was a right before the end of the year, one of the leading progressive groups had this draft Elizabeth Warren movement, and within a matter of days, they had, you know, hundreds of thousands of signatures behind her. You know, she has said she will not, she's not expected to run, you know, for president this time, but I would still just watch for her to be a force in shaping the party's message and its platform. She brings a real populist attitude and a real sort of fighting spirit for the little guy, which are ideas that are extremely popular among Americans, actually on both sides of the aisle. It's very interesting to see where some of the things that Elizabeth Warren and your caller mentioned, Senator Bernie Sanders, talk about actually have common cause with some on the right, you know, where they don't want to see Wall Street getting special treatment. They were, you know, both left and right were opposed during the lame duck session to what you had mentioned, you know, the rollback of treatment of these complex, you know, derivatives that people might remember from the financial meltdown, or the campaign finance rules, you know, the lame duck Congress eased the donations that wealthy members can make to the community. Those are all extremely popular issues. And I think Elizabeth Warren has shown that she's willing to sort of cause a ruckus, as she did during the lame duck session, but also sort of, you know, back down when she needs to, because that, you know, might be the more sort of political savvy way to go. You know, for example, she didn't keep the Senate in over session the way Ted Cruz did. And I think, you know, while that might be disappointing to some of the liberals in her base, you know, that also sort of showed that she was willing, you know, she wasn't going to sort of torch the place. You know, she was going to try to work within the structure to get the changes she wants. To me, that was a sign of a savvy, you know, someone who is new but is learning quickly, you know, how to try to make things work.
Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. Therese in Stevens Point, hi.
Hi. I would like to see Congress take another attempt at passing the Clay Hunt suicide prevention bill. That bill was held up by Senator Coburn right before he left office, although it was passed by the House, I understand. We lose 22 veterans a day due to suicide, and I think if we're going to send soldiers off to war, our society should put the effort and the funding into providing veterans with the services they need when they get home. Thank you, and I'll take my comments.
Thanks so much, Therese, for the call. Lisa.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that bill will probably be back. It enjoys widespread support. I think what you saw Senator Coburn doing was what Senator Coburn does or did. He's now retired, which was to really not, you know, it's very hard to vote against veterans, as you can imagine. The caller makes an excellent point that if, you know, the country's willing to send young men and women to war, we should be able to take care of them. And Congress, you know, often, you know, will do what it can to pass these bills. That bill, Senator Coburn argued, was, you know, duplicative of programs that were already available. And he argued that, you know, what we have to do is get the programs to work, not create a new bureaucracy. Obviously, there's different sides to that point of view. Congress was fast ready to support that bill. As the caller says, it enjoyed widespread support in the House. So I imagine it'll come back.
We had a really interesting, I'm sure you've seen this piece, Lisa, interview with James Fallows, who wrote a piece on the military in the current issue of The Atlantic. He was with us last week and had some very interesting things to say and some challenges for our lawmakers to look at what our goals are in fighting ISIS, how we're doing that, the kind of aircraft that we're spending billions of dollars on to fight this enemy, and one wonders whether or not we're being at all successful. Is there any move on Congress to have such an examination? Because we have this huge military budget, and we have this enemy we're fighting against, who everybody says will be with us for a long period of time. And yet there doesn't seem to be a lot of examination as to whether or not we're winning.
Yeah, you know, the overseas conflicts just are continue to be a mess for the Congress to try to, to oversee. I wish I had read the James Fallis piece. That sounds fascinating, and I'm sorry I didn't. What I think you'll see the Congress do is try to lean into this issue of whether the president has authority, you know, the authorization for the use of military force resolution, and that will open the door to this much broader debate that you are talking about of, you know, how are we spending the money? What are we doing? Is this working? And I think the answers to those questions are incredibly murky at this point, right? And
yes,
it's very difficult to see, we saw last year that the Congress, you know, after lots of sort of push and pull, did go ahead and free up some money and authority for the president to go ahead and arm the Syrian resistance. And, you know, and that we've seen how slow and laborious it is to get off the ground of vetting the Syrian opposition and, determining who we are going to back and give arms to and, you know, getting those folks trained. You know, it's very, very difficult. So I think there are, you know, political issues here. There are strategy issues. There are just, you know, the broader questions of, you know, what is the role of the United States in, you know, the policing the nation, right, or policing the world, being the world's policeman in this day and age. And you see enormous splits on both parties over the political route ahead. Of course, the Republicans are no longer the sort of homogenous defense party that they have been, defense hawks, you know, that they had been in the past, where you see the more libertarian wing of the party, really not interested in building up the military complex, engaging in overseas, operations the way just, 10 years ago the party was, quite willing to do. And you see that, again, that sort of interesting common ground between the libertarians on the right and, you know, the sort of what people would consider the traditional doves on the left, you know, of saying no more, no more. So, but, you know, everyone knows it's a very dangerous world. And so, I think even Rand Paul, who was really sort of among the leading libertarians, you know, said, okay, I'm not an isolationist. You know, I think we have a role here. So it's very tricky.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and you're listening to All Things Political, the first in the new year. Our guest is Lisa Mascaro, and she is in D.C. right now. She covers for the L.A. Times, Chicago Tribune, and other papers, the Washington News. She covers U.S. policy, economics, political culture, and our number this week as we talk about the Republicans taking over both chambers of Congress, the issues that are front and center for them, the rifts within the Republican Party, the rifts within the Democratic Party, the future of the Affordable Care Act, we have yet to get to that, future of immigration reform, where there might be compromise, 800-486-8655. Ruth in Madison, hi.
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 What I wish I could see, and I don't know if it would be like a Warren wing of the Democrats that could do it, or if we need a whole new party. But I would just love to see an appeal made to the fourth grader in all of us who sat there in history class thinking to ourselves, daydreaming, if I had been alive back when the revolution was happening, I would have been aware and I would have been brave. Or if I had been alive when slavery was happening, I would have been brave. I would have spoke out. I would have fought against it. Because now, while we've got this oligarchy with the moneyed interests telling even the parties who can even be in the party practically, evidence Bernie Sanders, nobody is brave and nobody is smart and nobody's wise and we're all not paying attention. We're all buying what they sell in the commercials. And if we wouldn't buy it, it wouldn't be so valuable. But that's why money matters in politics, is because they are buying us.
Lisa.
Well, you know, your caller raises a really interesting point. I mean, I think two things I would say right off the bat is that money in politics, as your listeners I'm sure well know, you know, every year I think we report, or every 2 years we report, you know, it's the most expensive year ever, right?
Sure
most
is.
Expensive election ever. We were having this conversation the other day, like, it never goes down. It just always goes up. And, you know, we've seen the, again, continued loosening of the campaign finance rules. You see the enormous sums that are being spent. You know, I noticed it on the campaign trail. You know, we go out and cover, you know, the different congressional races. And it's so interesting for me to hear what messages voters hear and not hear. You know, and I'll be talking to voters at a town hall meeting or in a grocery store parking lot or, you know, wherever. And, you know, sometimes you can hear the commercials being read back to you, you know, and I think, boy, that stuff really, you know, people say they hate it and they just want to turn the commercials off and they don't want to hear this stuff. But, you know, it does sink in to some extent, you know, it takes a lot, you know, for people. We have all this, you know, media available to us now 24/7. We've got everything in these succinct little, you know, tweets of 140 characters. So there's enormous amounts of information available. But I think, you know, curating that and processing that and sort of thinking deeply about these issues remains a constant challenge. And, you know, of course, we always say democracy needs a, you know, an engaged electorate and, you know, getting voter numbers higher and making sure that there's access to the polls and people are going to the polls, you know, all of that really plays in. And, you know, that said, I wouldn't paint a sort of total gloom and doom picture. I think, you know, things are always cyclical in politics. And, you know, I think people do tune in when, you know, when the going gets really tough. And so, you know, hopefully people will continue to, you know, sort of escalate their engagement and,
right.
Yeah, pay attention.
You serve as a role model, Ruth, and thank you very much for your call. What is the future of the Affordable Care Act? When is the Supreme Court making their decision? What will the Republicans do? They've really made it a goal to take it apart piece by piece. What will be the congressional actions this year?
Yeah, so I think what you will definitely see from Congress is some piecemeal attempts to dismantle portions of the Affordable Care Act, and we can talk about that. And then, of course, the court will be hearing arguments in early spring on the latest challenge, and, you know, we'll have a decision sometime by the end of the term if they decide, you know, that would be expected, you know, probably some time before they leave, which is usually late June. So that is the judicial front. On the legislative front, what you will see right off the bat, Speaker Boehner has talked about let me just say more broadly that there are portions of the Affordable Care Act that have raised concerns among both not only just Republicans but also Democrats. And that is, I think, going to be the leading Republican strategy, is to go back after those individual provisions where Republicans think they can pick off some support from Democrats, especially the support that the Senate would need to reach that 60 vote threshold, you know, to clear the hurdles in the Senate, pass some of those and get those on Obama's desk and really pressure the president to either, you know, sign or veto them, right? And that is going to be a huge challenge between either end of Pennsylvania Avenue this year. Those provisions, you know, some are more innocuous than others. Some start to really dismantle the act, and that's where I think you will see Democrats and the president really fight back. Others, like I said, are maybe things that Democrats could stomach, the president could agree to. One is this issue of, you know, what is full-time work? So under the Affordable Care Act, you know, employees working 30 hours are considered full-time employees. Then they have to either be provided insurance or, you know, go get their insurance through other avenues, either on their own or through the exchange. Republicans want to restore what they call the 40-hour work week. Okay, well, let's see how that goes. Is that something that Democrats can agree to? Is that something that would, you know, begin to dismantle the act? or not. Others are more difficult. Like if you look at something like the medical device tax, there is a device on medical device manufacturers, a tax, I'm sorry, on medical device manufacturers, that a number of Democrats, your neighbors there in Minnesota, support getting rid of that tax, states with big companies that are making these medical devices. However, that provides an enormous amount of revenue that is part of this bigger, you know, picture of how Obamacare works. Part of that revenue then goes to help provide the subsidies for, you know, the population to go who cannot afford insurance to afford it. So, you know, you start pulling away one revenue stream like that, then that is going to really sort of, you know, kind of start collapsing the way the system works now. So you would see, I think, much more pushback on something like that. These are going to be, you know, the Republicans still say they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Of course, that even if they get the votes, which it wouldn't be able to get out of the Senate probably because of that 60-vote threshold, you know, of course Obama would veto that, right? But can they make progress on some of these other elements? That's going to be key.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I was just going to ask her if she thinks that is there any possibility that we can, like, pull out of the Mideast and Eastern Europe, NATO, pull NATO back like we promised the Soviet Union, and when they decided to break up, that we promised the Soviet Union we would never move NATO east towards Russia. And now we're right on their doorstep with missiles and everything in the Ukraine. And we're in the Middle East. We're in all over the world. We got 600,000 people, soldiers, et cetera, plus black operations all over the world. Why don't we just dismantle that stuff, bring the Americans back to America, and quit trying to order the world around and make it into a one-world government and one-world bank and one-world dictatorship.
Do you hear those kinds of voices in Washington or not, Lisa?
Yeah, you know, I think that is, you know, of course in Washington, you know, you really hear all sides, and, you know, that is a view, but certainly there are counter views to that. And I think, you know, especially people would look at what's going on with Putin's aggression into the Ukraine, you know, with the geographic expansion into Ukraine, and say, you know, somebody needs to put a check on that. And of course the United States in both the Middle East and elsewhere increasingly tries, you know, to form coalition government, you know, coalition forces to do what it's trying to do. Of course, even George Bush tried to do that with the, you know, so-called coalition of the willing or coalition, right, to go into Iraq. You know, those are difficult, sometimes with more success than not. But, you know, I just don't think there would be an appetite for sort of more fully withdrawing from the world stage the way the caller envisions. It just doesn't seem like that is a role that a majority here in Congress would lean into.
More phone calls in a moment. You're listening to All Things Political for this first Monday in 2015. Lisa Mascaro is our guest. She's been with us before. She covers Congress in Washington, writes about economics, U.S. policy, political culture for the L.A. Times, Chicago Tribune, and other papers. She's at the Trib's D.C. Bureau. Our phone number, what hopes do you have for Congress? What about the rifts in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. There also was, and there still is, continuing discussion of the number three House Republican, Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana, who apologized last week for delivering this talk in 2002 to a white supremacist group headed by David Duke. Is his seat in trouble? Will he be able to get through this? We'll talk with Lisa about that and other subjects as well, including we'll talk about the economy and about the incoming House budget chair, she writes about Representative Tom Price of Georgia, who's vowing to deliver a spending blueprint that builds on the austerity outlined by Paul Ryan, cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and other safety net programs. We'll talk about those as well. So, all of that coming up. Stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lisa Mascaro is here now. All things political is what we are discussing at this very moment. Let's just spend a moment on Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana. Obviously, the press secretary for Obama mentioned him a couple times today. Is this over, or does he stand to perhaps lose his seat over this appearance before the white supremacist group?
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you, Republicans would love to be for it to be over. And Democrats were out of the chute this morning. First things in my inbox were, attacks from Democratic leaders about why Republicans were continuing to stand by Mr. Scalise. I don't know if it's over. You know, this came when we were all sort of getting back on track here last week. And boy, Republican leaders really tried to rally around him. Steve Scalise, I will tell you, is a very sort of likable guy. People, sort of were very heartened to see him come into leadership. He's someone who can really talk to both the conservative and the sort of more pragmatic wing of the party. People around the Republicans felt like he was a good get for leaders this cycle to have, hoisted him into the number three position. You know, that said, these conservative states are very conservative, and these issues of race are always, sort of right under the surface in a lot of the political discussions in a lot of the conservative states. And I'm not at all trying to say that Mr. Scalise, leans into that, because, I think he has definitely distanced himself from the group and apologized for them. And I'm sure, again, this was 10 years ago for him, or 12 years ago that this happened. He was just trying to build support for some, budgetary measures in his own state house. These are constituents, in conservative states, right? These are just constituents. That said, when you get on the national stage like this, that's going to be a real problem, and Democrats are not about to, let it be forgotten that, a top Republican leader, spoke to a group that's affiliated with a KKK leader.
Matt in Sparta, hi.
Hi there. My question for the guest is anybody in Washington talking about the indefinite detention clause of the North American Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA? I know that's been derisive amongst the Republican Party between libertarians and more traditional conservatives, and I know pretty much every Democrat is opposed to it, including the president initially, who eventually signed it into law anyway. I was wondering if there's any conversation about that during the New Year period here.
Oh, gosh, I'm sorry. I don't know that issue well enough. I will look into that and see. I don't know if the caller is still there, but I was wondering if you could give me a little bit more.
I don't either. What's the NDAA? Matt?
So the North American Defense Authorization Act is a defense bill they pass, I believe, every year. It's to fund the military, basically. And
right, it is. But what's the indefinite detention clause? I'm sorry, what's the indefinite detention clause that you're talking about? That's the part I was stumbling on.
Right. So the indefinite detention clause is one of the little things that got flipped in there a couple of years ago. It's a big bill, so they put little riders in there all the time. And it allowed the executive branch, particularly, to indefinitely detain an American for without a jury, without a trial, for an indefinite amount of time. For terrorist activity, suspected terrorist activity.
Basically. Yeah, okay, so that's probably right, wrapped up in all that. I do know the defense bill, and he's absolutely right. There's always a gazillion amendments on it. Of course, this year they attached that, enormous lands bill package, with like 88 different, public lands provisions, which is sort of, the height of like attaching stuff to the defense bill. I don't know enough about the indefinite detention policy to give you an answer on that, but I'll definitely look into it and see if that's something that's coming back this year. It sounds to me like it's part of the, the sort of 9/11 reforms that were put into place that continue to be talked about every year when they talk about, reauthorizing the Patriot Act and the, the different NSA, eavesdropping provisions. And I know there has been some talk about who can get, I know there's been a lot of discussion about those issues and the detention issues, but I'm sorry, I don't know that one enough specifically.
Thank you, Matt. This is an issue that potentially could affect a lot of people. What about this incoming House Budget Chair, Representative Tom Price of Georgia. You write that he vows to deliver a spending blueprint that builds on the austerity outlined by Paul Ryan with cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and other safety net programs.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tom Price is from Georgia. He's the new Republican chairman taking over for Paul Ryan at the Budget Committee. And he had a briefing with a number of us reporters at the end of the year where he basically outlined that, you know, the Paul Ryan budgets are sort of the starting point. You know, that he, I think his quote was, the issues around the Paul Ryan budget have been normalized. And so the idea of, you know, turning Medicare into a voucher-like system, you know, where people would, you know, choose if they want to just to take the cash and go buy their own, you know, coverage as seniors, and sort of changing the way traditional Medicare is set up, changing the way Medicaid is set up. So all of that ends up cutting those programs. A lot of the social programs takes very sizable cuts under the Paul Ryan blueprint. And, it, you know, it took Paul Ryan some time to get the budget to balance. First, he was trying to balance it in 20 years, then down to 10 years. Well, Mr. Price says he's going to definitely have the budget balance in 10 years, and that would take, you know, just an enormous amount of cuts, and that will be a very big conversation in the months ahead, coming this spring, between Democrats and Republicans. Now, these budgets don't get signed into law. They are just blueprints, but they give the directions to the Appropriations Committees, the Appropriation Committee, that then decides, okay, we have this top line number, so, you know, here is the money that the budget says for each of these individual, you know, areas of the government, and that ends up being the big spending bills that we talk about every year. So you can sort of see the groundwork that Congressman Price is laying for this. Of course, the president will come out with his own budget in early February, and I'm sure it will look a lot different than what Dr. Price is. He's a medical doctor. Dr. Price is proposing, and again, you know, just the enormous cuts to get the budget into balance. It would just, I think people always love to hear the idea of a balanced budget, but to do that actually takes an enormous amount of cuts.
Sure.
Yeah.
Jonathan in Fox River Valley. Hi.
Good afternoon. Happiest of New Year's.
You
Why
too.
Why don't we ever, ever talk about cutting the defense spending?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Dr. Price, the one thing he talked about was really trying to protect defense spending, and so not having it sort of endure any further cuts, but really having the cuts that would be needed to bring the budget into balance occur on the what we call the domestic side. So that would be domestic discretionary spending, but also all of the what we call entitlement spending. So, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, the programs that are sort of on a bit of autopilot each year because they are, you know, programs that we've decided are going to be part of the federal budget. So you're going to see a really robust debate over exactly what the caller is asking, whether, you know, money should be spent on defense or discretion. Again, I will say that's an interesting area where Republicans, you know, are now divided. You know, in the past, it was always sort of the defense hawks Republicans that were, you know, willing to support the military, and now you have this new sort of generation of the more Tea Party libertarian style Republicans who don't like, you know, any big government, whether it's big government social programs or big government, you know, military programs. And so that's an interesting division and an interesting area where Democrats and Republicans might find some common ground.
Thank you, Jonathan. But on the whole, we have about 25 seconds. Do you think there will be much common ground? Do you have high hopes for compromise in the new year?
No, I don't. I think when, you know, it comes to September 30th and it's time to fund the government again, you know, it's going to be really difficult to see. You know, the Republican Congress will send over a number of these smaller spending bills to the president, and, you know, they will probably be able to pass them out of Congress, but, you know, will the president want to sign these things? And that's going to be the debate. That's what we're going to see play out all spring and summer. And then, you know, come September 30th, we've got to fund the government or, you know, be prepared for a shutdown. And, you know, that's we'll be back at that conversation.
Lisa, thank you ever so much. Happy New Year to you. Thanks for being with us.
You too, Kathleen. Thanks so much.
Lisa Mascaro, our guest this hour. Lisa covers Congress for the L.A. Times, Chicago Tribune, and other papers, part of that syndicate at the Tribune D.C. Bureau. Also worked for the Las Vegas Sun and contributed as the paper won the Pulitzer Prize for public service. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and to Cynthia Schuster for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Just a reminder, we do All Things Political if you're listening for the first time every Monday at 1 o'clock. So it's our regularly scheduled hour of politics. Stay with us.